Krishna comes to me and he says, "Hey, I'm buying Bitcoin because it's going to 140K. And I was laughing because I've seen Bitcoin from a technology perspective. I know it's very innovative and stuff, but I've never looked at it through an economic lens. This is the Bitcoin Infinity Podcast,
a show where we take you through the Bitcoin rabbit hole and beyond.
Hope you enjoy the episode. Hello and welcome to the very first episode of Bitcoin Infinity Podcast. My name is Ram.
And I am Krishna.
To understand Bitcoin, we need to cover some basic topics like the current macro landscape, what money is from the first principles, so that we can set the stage up for Bitcoin. And why start yet another Bitcoin podcast? There's so many out there. So, well, Krishna and I have been trying to get a bunch of our friends to get into Bitcoin. And we started seeing a lot of patterns in the questions that people asked, like, is Bitcoin a scam? Bitcoin doesn't have any intrinsic value. Bitcoin is for gamblers. Bitcoin will be shut by the government. Bitcoin is literally boiling the oceans. So we wanted to address these kind of misconceptions and sharing these or clarifying these misconceptions by a podcast might not be a bad idea after all. Krishna, you want to add anything?
Also, we thought it would be a great platform for us to learn as we dive deeper into this rabbit hole. And before we dive right in, we wanted to share our background stories as to how we got into Bitcoin. For me, I'm a material scientist. You know, a lot of my friends, they are engineers. Some of them are software engineers. For us, all of us, we keep thinking, what is a way to make more money? We wanted to get better jobs in terms of the pay. So we also wanted to focus on our jobs, get a raise in the salary, etc. But even for me, I realized that I never thought about what is money, like how the money that I'm earning, how am I going to protect my wealth? You know, we are always thinking about, okay, how can I multiply it? That's kind of how I got into this. So my first instance was I came across this cryptocurrency called Ripple in 2017. Again, my first thinking was, oh, this thing is only 18 cents and there is another crypto called Bitcoin that's trading at 3,000. So if this Ripple catches on with people, that's also going to at some point become $1,000 or maybe more. So why don't I put some money in this, multiply my money, and there I go. I've increased my money. That's a win for me, right? So that's how I got into crypto. I traded a lot of shit coins, saw my money multiply. That kind of gave me a lot of adrenaline. And then I also saw this thing called Bitcoin that kept driving the market. But again, thought that's not the only thing, right? There are like 1,000 cryptocurrencies. So there is always going to be another Bitcoin. So again, that was my first instance where I came across Bitcoin. And then I just, after the 2018 crash, which happened because the bear market started, I just thought, okay, all my fun is over. Let me go back and make more money through, you know, stocks, do Robinhood, etc. And then came the 2020 market crash. But before I get into that, why don't we ask Ram as to how he got into Bitcoin?
Yeah, it's a very similar story. I actually got, by the way, I'm a software engineer by profession. I get to know all these latest, whatever is new in software world, because that's my profession. So I got to know about Bitcoin back in like 2015. And I even gave like a presentation at my work. So that was my first touch point. I didn't do anything. I didn't invest. I regret it now. But then, yeah, I didn't buy Bitcoin back then. Next touch point was alongside Krishna during the 2017-18 bull run. Like he said, I've never ever questioned what money is. I've wanted to just put my money in stocks. I've just started learning how the stock market works and stuff. And I got to know Bitcoin price went up crazy. There was this hard fork. And that's when the Bcash hard fork had happened. And everything was going up in the crypto land. So I thought, okay, let's put money in Bitcoin. And it's a slippery slope. I just read Bitcoin as a technology. And the reason I say it's a slippery slope is like you start reading what is the next Bitcoin, what is the next big technology, what are smart contracts, what is blockchain 3.0, and you start reading about Cardano and all these shit coins. And yeah, I made a lot of money. I lost it all in 2018. And yeah, but one thing that I'm proud of myself is I sort of consolidated most of my losses back to Bitcoin, and I started doing dollar cost averaging against Bitcoin. And heading into 2020, even before the March 2020 crash, I was aware of Bitcoin's halving event, where the block reward gets halved every 4 years. So May 2020 had halving, and I was just asking my friends to, like, hey, why don't you get back into Bitcoin, because that's halving and Bitcoin's price is hovering around 6,000-7,000 at the minimum. Because of the supply shock of the halving, it's going to double. So that was my sort of third proper interaction with Bitcoin, as in the halving event, or the upcoming halving event was what, that was my third infraction. Yeah, and then came the March 2020 crash. And Krishna, why don't you?
So yeah, so the 2020 market crash happened. And I was wondering why the market crashed. So then I thought, okay, it's going to get even worse, right? I mean, this pandemic, the more people are going into unemployment. So this is not the end of the crash. I mean, it should not be, right? So I thought, okay, this market is going to go much, much lower. And then I'm looking at the stock market. It's just jumping. It's like going up every single day. And I'm thinking, okay, this is just, the correction. It's going to drop again. But it never dropped. So that's when I started looking into YouTube, some videos of what's going on, what is all this. And that's when I came across something called QE and things like that. And
do you want to explain what QE is?
So QE basically means a quantitative easing. You know, it's a very nice economic term, but to put it in a very simple terms, it's just printing money, which is like inflating the current supply of money. Or in other terms, it's just we refer to as money printer go burr. So they can just keep printing money as much as I want. So again, these things were happening. That's when I came across a random YouTube video, and it was saying that, hey, Bitcoin is at $8,000 right now, and in a year and a half, it's going to go to $140,000-$150,000. And I was thinking, this is crazy. Is this a clickbait or something? But I thought, okay, anyway, I was a person who does fall into clickbait, so why don't I just click on this? So that's when I started understanding Bitcoin in from a very modeling point of view, because he was explaining a lot of models as to it's going to 140K, 150K. These are the models. These are the things happening. So anyway, that's how I got into Bitcoin in 2020. Then rest of it is a huge story. Once you get in, dip your toe in, then you just fall into the rabbit hole. So Ram, was your journey similar to at that point?
Yeah. So so the halving happened. Bitcoin's price didn't change much. It was around like $9,000 or something like that. Then Krishna comes to me and he says, hey, I'm buying Bitcoin because it's going to 140K. And here I was laughing, because I've seen Bitcoin from a technology perspective. I know it's very innovative and stuff, but I've never looked at it through an economic lens, and I just laughed off. And then I started getting in, and I started looking into QE, and I started realizing, like, government through this stimulus, they started saving these big corporations from going bankrupt. And to top it off, these companies would buy back their shares. And
I remember a story here when he says that, because I think this is what happened in 2008 as well, right? I mean, there was this subprime mortgage crisis, which means, banks were just lending out loans to everyone. You can be anyone you want. You don't even have to show a good collateral. At the end of the crash, everyone got ruined, but the banks were just happy because the government saved them. Like how Ram explained, the government always saves these big corporations, but the people, they got their asses kicked. So yeah, it is just to add to your story.
Yeah. So here I'm seeing government inflating the money supply, there is definitely going to be inflation. And obviously, all these stimulus is just a drug, and we know it's going to make the poor poorer. It's like the death by a thousand paper cuts, right? Like eventually, it's going to show up. And then I realize, okay, whatever I'm earning right now, it's going to be meaningless in next couple of years, because let's say I'm earning $100,000, I'm saving $50,000. It's going to be worth less than $50,000 in 3 years. As simple as that. So money in my bank is getting devalued over time. That's when I started looking Bitcoin from an economic perspective. And the model that Krishna had shared started to make sense. Like Bitcoin had like a predictable supply, and it is possible to sort of predict based on the Bitcoin supply curve to actually model out the price in X amount of years. And the model that Krishna had shared was none other than Plan B's famous stock flow model.
So understanding Bitcoin from an economic perspective was a complete paradigm shift for us. We realized that it's just not another new technology, but it's a biggest invention of this century. And, you know, an invention that has the potential to change or, you know, impact the lives of billions of people.
So we've covered the current economic landscape, and I think why don't we shift gears to discuss money from first principles, and also sort of discuss like a brief history of money. So money as we know it right now has existed only for the last 50 years or so, and historically money has been the most liquid and tradable asset. And let's take an example. Let's say I am a cattle farmer and Krishna here sells only apples. And let's say the conversion for one cattle gives me 100 apples. And let's say I need to get like 5 apples so that I can eat. And I am willing to give him a cattle and he's going to give me 100 apples. But then I don't need 100 apples right now, because I just need 5, and I know apples are going to be perishable and it won't stand the test of time. So we start running into issues in barter system. That's when a common medium of exchange was needed. That's how money as we know it historically was created. And again, historically money sort of naturally selected based on these 5-6 properties. Let's go over them. This will be important when we come back to discuss about Bitcoin. So money needs to be divisible. So basically money needs to transact at varying scales. You should be able to subdivide money, or you should be able to recombine smaller units to get the required monetary value. And second, money needs to be durable. So money will have to persist over time. For example, apples, like I said, are poor money because it's perishable. And third is money needs to be portable. So money needs to move across space. I should be able to exchange with ease. So that is very critical. Next is money needs to be recognizable. Like everyone, if it's a medium of exchange, it should be recognizable. And lastly, the key property, money needs to be scarce in the sense it needs to be resistant to counterfeiting and supply inflation.
So here I'd like to jump in and talk about a story from history. So this story happened in Western Africa, where people were using glass beads as in money or as a medium of exchange, because it was quite rare in Western Africa. And what ended up happening was when European settlers just came in, and at that time Europeans had figured out the glass making technology, which means that for them glass beads were not scarce because they could manufacture glass beads at will. So when they came into Western Africa, they realized that they can just produce glass beads, infinite amount of them at a very low cost. And using that, they could start buying things for cheap in Western Africa, which eventually led them to make some of those Western Africans as slaves. So these glass beads are commonly known as slave beads. So yeah.
Yeah, so that's a very good example of how scarcity is important. So with money, everyone has a direct financial incentive to increase the supply in circulation. And what it does is it allows the person who can create the new supply sort of a mechanism to confiscate wealth and value from those who use the money. In this example, the Europeans were able to confiscate value from people who are using glass beads as money. So yeah, that's why scarcity is the most important property of money.
So many things have been tried in the past as money, like seashells have been tried, cattle has been tried, even salt has been used as money at some point. But one thing all of these lacked was they were not scarce. And naturally, the world zeroed in on monetary metals because they satisfied most of the properties of money. And gold among all of those monetary metals was really scarce, as it was really, really hard to produce. So one property that stood out about gold was its demand to supply ratio. So let's say there is a sudden increase in the demand for gold. Because the process to mine gold is not straightforward, it cannot happen overnight. I cannot meet that demand with a sudden increase in the supply of gold, which means that it was a really hard money. And history has shown us that hard money prevails over money that is just easy to create.
I'd like to add a quick example from Saifedean's book, The Bitcoin Standard, which we highly recommend reading. The example goes like, let's say there's a billionaire and the billionaire thinks copper is the best form of money. So he's going to buy $10 billion worth of copper. And as his bankers are buying copper, the price of copper is going to rise. So the billionaire would think that he was a genius and he put money in copper and price of copper is running high. And but what the billionaire doesn't see is like right now copper price is so high that everyone is going to stop whatever they're doing because they're now incentivized to mine copper. So everyone is going to start mining copper, thereby increasing the supply and again as a result driving the price down to its original price. So this is possible because copper is easy to produce. And you're saying gold being hard to produce sort of beats this trap.
That's correct. And in order to understand this concept better, you know, there is a term called stock to flow, which is used to quantify the hardness where, you know, we've referred to gold being a hard money. But so it's important to understand what that hardness is. So stock to flow ratio is a popular model that assumes that scarcity drives value. It is defined as the ratio of the current stock of a commodity and the flow of new production. So in order to explain it in simple terms, gold has a stock to flow value of 55, which means that at the current rate of production of gold, it will take me 55 years in order to reach the current total stock of gold that's available across this world.
So it's basically the inverse inflation rate. So gold's S2F being 55. So inflation rate for gold is one of the lowest, which is 1 over 55, which is around like 1.8%.
You would think something like a platinum would have a really high stock to flow, but it turns out that it's not. It has a stock to flow which is one of the lowest, say somewhere around 0.4. And which means 1 over 0.4, that's approximately 260%. And that's the inflation rate of platinum.
And I think like silver has a decent stock to flow of around 20.
That's true. And as we saw, of all the monetary metals, gold has the highest stock to flow, which means it's really hard to inflate every passing year.
So although gold sort of championed in terms of scarcity, gold lagged in three other money properties, which is gold wasn't very divisible in the sense like gold, you could turn gold into gold coins, but then if I need to buy, let's say a coffee, you would have to give me like a gold dust. So it wasn't very feasible for gold to be divisible at a very smaller scale. And gold was also not recognizable. There were instances in the history where like gold was adulterated with silver or other metals, and it's hard to verify whatever a chunk of gold that you've given me is pure gold. So that's where gold lacked in terms of recognizability. And finally, gold definitely lacked in terms of portability. Like there was a lot of costs associated with transporting gold, including like the logistics and the cost of providing security for gold. And what happened as a result was this led to like creation of businesses that would sort of certify gold for paper certificates. So they would hold your gold and they would give you a paper certificate. At the end of the day, if you give them the paper certificate back, they would give you your gold back. So this naturally was called as currency. So, and these businesses which had the custody of gold sort of led to centralization of the gold custody into fewer hands, and these led to you know where I'm heading at, these led to creation of banks, and ultimately like these banks had to settle gold once a month. So people thought, okay, let's create something called a central bank where all the gold would sit, and all the other banks will have to do is just move the money in the ledger, and they would just give these paper certificates. So that's how in history banks and central bank was born. It's actually a private business, private entity that was created to have your gold custody, and which would give paper certificates, also known as currency, in return. So there was no government. There was no government at play. It wasn't a government currency. It was just a central bank issuing paper certificates that was called as currency. And do you want to discuss the problems with the centralization of gold custody?
Yeah. So, like Ram mentioned, as the gold was getting more centralized into these central banks, like fewer entities, they had the temptation to violate. So like during the World War I period, most countries which were on the gold standard, they wanted to produce more money. So they started issuing more of these certificates, and they needed that to do that in order to fund their war. So they wanted to win the war at all costs. And this inflow of currency caused hyperinflation. So it happened in Weimar Republic, which is the current day Germany, where the currency hyperinflated, and that resulted in the economy.
Yeah, the Great Depression and recession.
Exactly, right. So after the war, the countries returned to the safety of the gold standard, but it had created a huge problem.
So far the countries have been on the gold standard, even with paperback currencies. And now comes, in 1944, the historic Bretton Woods Agreement, wherein US proposed a new global monetary system. So it basically replaced the gold standard with the US dollar as the global currency. By doing so, it meant that America, as a dominant power, it had just won the World War, and it was a dominant power in the world economy, if it sets dollar as the global currency. And after the agreement was signed, America was the only country that could print US dollars. And why US? Because US had 75% of the world's global gold supply. Like countries had entrusted US to keep their gold safe. And US had played a smart move in saying, hey, why don't I keep all the gold and I produce the dollars, and all you need to do is keep those dollars, and if you give the dollars back, and we will give you your gold back. And like we mentioned before, like historically, if you give a central entity the power to control the monetary supply, they will violate it. And yeah, I think France tried to repatriate the gold. US took 2 years, and things started to seem fishy. So what US was doing was US had started this fractional reserve currency, which means the amount of gold that was backing the dollars was let loose. Like there was more dollars printed for the amount of gold that was backed. And when France had asked this gold back, and US was struggling to give it back, and it took them almost 2 years. And when other countries started asking their gold back, I think it was Germany or Britain. And that's when Nixon, who was the president of United States, he said, okay, dollar is no more redeemable for gold. And they've sort of betrayed whatever the agreement was back in 1944. And this was commonly known as the Nixon shock. And it was the birth of what we know as fiat standard. Basically, it's a fiat currency that is not pegged to anything, and money is free floating, and the central bank has all the power to create as much money as they want. And Krishna, do you have anything to add?
Yes. So there is this really interesting website called WTF happened in 1971.com. Do check it out. So it actually compares a lot of interesting statistics of things that happened, comparing things before 1971 and after 1971, things like the wages, the food costs, the GDP, the per capita, etc. And even though correlation doesn't mean causation, it is inevitable that these statistics actually point to the problem that we have with the fiat currency.
So yeah, fast forward to present day, central banks are still exploiting and abusing the power to create more money. They keep inflating the money supply as and when it's needed. We start to realize they're confiscating value that we create. And this sort of necessitated the need for a decentralized currency. And being in the information age, a lot of people try to create digital gold. There's been instances of a project called Hashcash, there's Bitgold, there's eGold. If you know anything digital, anything that's got to do with information just bits, and information can be copied. And all of these digital gold, eGold concepts, they sort of had this huge flaw, which is it can be copied. And a lot of these technologies evolved, like cryptography evolved. And I think 2008 financial crash was sort of the tipping point, and that's what led this mysterious white paper to come out, which is Bitcoin. So what Bitcoin solved was, it solved the problem of copying a digital value. So basically, it's popularly known as the double spending problem. Satoshi came up with this brilliant idea of expending energy in real life to actually mine the digital currency or the digital asset. And that's how Bitcoin was born. And we can cover Bitcoin in detail.
Yeah, there's one more thing that it's important to touch upon at this point. Was it solved one of the most important problems, which is double spending. But in addition, it also solved a problem which had actually caused a lot of chaos in what we had discussed, around 1971, everything, which was, trust on a mutual party. Like, what Bitcoin solved was, now you do not need a third party on whom you need to trust with your funds or, whatever you wanted to save. Again, we can cover more about Bitcoin.
So yeah, Bitcoin is decentralized in the sense there is no one central entity controlling the supply. And it is
senseless. So I always get asked this question. You know, every time I try to, you know, explain this to my parents or a lot of people who are, you know, who have very peripheral knowledge on crypto, is who's owning Bitcoin? Like, you know, what if the guy who owns Bitcoin steals your money? It's a very difficult concept for a lot of people to comprehend. Is Bitcoin is not owned by anyone. Bitcoin is, it's like saying who owns the internet? Nobody owns the internet, right? It's the same way. That's just Bitcoin. Bitcoin is just...
And yeah, that's the magic sauce of Bitcoin, because Satoshi did two amazing things. One was creating Bitcoin. Second was disappearing from Bitcoin. So
even if he appeared right now, right? Even if he said, okay, I'm going to cash out all the Bitcoins that he have, Bitcoin would still survive. It will just make Bitcoin even more
stronger.
So
more distributed, yeah.
I think it's reached a point where it doesn't matter, you know, who comes or who doesn't, because at this point and at no point, Bitcoin is not owned by anyone.
And yeah, I think that's a fair question for any shitcoin, because it is owned by the founders. They have significant pre-mine, and at any point they can add like a backdoor and anything. Like, anyway,
I remember, I think these days something is coming up on Twitter, which is called Dino. You know what Dino means? Have you heard of it?
Decentralized in name only. Yeah.
So that's literally every other coin except Bitcoin is Dino. Because every other coin, someone's going to come around and tell you, hey, I'm the CEO of this coin, which basically defeats the purpose of decentralization, right? I mean, what's a CEO doing in a decentralized coin? So again, Bitcoin is truly decentralized. It's the only truly decentralized cryptocurrency. Nobody owns it. Nobody, like, everyone can change the code, but it doesn't matter. So those are the things that we want to cover. Again, can Bitcoin be hacked? Yes, it can be hacked. But is it possible? No, it's not possible.
Yeah, it's just plain cryptography. So if Bitcoin gets hacked, basically it means cryptography is getting hacked, like your SHA-256 algorithm is getting hacked, which means we have a problem in every other security applications, like your banking application is hacked in the sense. So yeah, can Bitcoin be hacked? Yes, but is it possible? Is it probable? No. Yeah, it's all probabilistic. But then Bitcoin cannot be hacked. Bitcoin is immutable. Like, you and I can change the code, but are the miners gonna adopt your code? Probably not.
Yeah, so those are again things that we want to cover in terms of what miners are, etc. But this is just for, you know, people who want to, you know, skip to the end and see, okay, just tell me the answer, right?
Is Bitcoin better than gold? What is your take? Does Bitcoin satisfy all the money properties?
So again, this is, I think, another important thing we have to discuss, because since we've discussed so much of, you know, gold's properties and why gold failed, you know, the three important characteristics or the properties which gold failed. So let's just go back and look into those three properties and see how, or maybe we can just look at all the properties and see how Bitcoin compares to gold, right? I mean, that gives us an idea of if Bitcoin is better than gold, or, you know, it's equal to gold or what. So let's say divisibility, right? One of the properties, Bitcoin is much, much better than gold. I mean, you can divide Bitcoins up to 10 to the power of negative 8.
Yeah, 100 million Satoshis, that's
so,
what it's called.
So one Bitcoin is, you know, divisible into 100 million smaller units. I mean, it's just math. So,
and even if Bitcoin grows to a huge number where the least count, which is like one Satoshi, is not good enough, we can always do a code change, which is like a soft fork, because anything you change after the decimal is not going to matter. So even if you change, if you make it more divisible, it's not going to affect the property, the scarcity property of Bitcoin.
That's, yeah. So one pizza, how many ever times you cut it, it's always one pizza.
Exactly.
So it can only feed 2 people. It cannot feed 100 people. But
yeah.
So divisibility is something that Bitcoin is better than gold. We can say, so that part is done. Now let's go to durability. Will Bitcoin persist over time?
Yeah, it's just information and...
If you look at history, gold has been durable. I mean, across time it survived. So Bitcoin has survived the last 10 years. It's gone through a lot of, you know, ups and downs, a lot of misinformations. We call it FUD. It's gone through that. Of course, the time will only tell if Bitcoin will survive the test of time and all of these things. But in just in terms of the physical properties, it just exists as long as internet exists.
Exactly. Yeah, it's just information. So as long as you have internet, as long as you have one node surviving, even if you have like a nuclear disaster erasing 98% of the world, like if there's 2% of Bitcoin nodes still running, we still have Bitcoin that survives. And yeah, Bitcoin is much, much more durable than gold.
How about the next property?
Yeah, is it next property is portability. Yeah, is Bitcoin more portable than gold? Yeah, it's super quick. Like gold, like we said, gold, you need to put it in safe trucks and transport it. And Bitcoin can, I can send Bitcoin to another person on the other side of the world and it clears in 10 minutes. There is no other technology or no other money that clears in 10 minutes. And you might think like you sending money across the globe, like if you do a Western money wire transfer, you send money and it goes there. But then if you understand like money, how current money works, it takes like 2 to 3 months to clear, honestly.
Even if you just say the current way how it works, you have to do it from 9 to 5. You can't do it on weekends.
Yeah.
And there's not even a debate here. Bitcoin is a much superior technology in terms of portability.
Yeah, recognizability or fungibility. Like since it's information, you can easily say, hey, one Bitcoin is one Bitcoin. It's just pure math. Yeah, there's no question when it compares to gold. And finally, scarcity. This is the 21 million question. So there will only ever be 21 million Bitcoins. Dot. Bitcoin is immutable. And if you fast forward to like 2140, 2200, I can for sure say Bitcoin, there will only have been 21 million Bitcoins ever. So that's not true with gold. Gold is scarce, but people have not mined under the sea. People can potentially mine asteroids. There could be a new supply of gold hidden under my house, which I haven't discovered, and it could be 50% the supply of world's gold. We don't know. It's not been explored. But yeah, Bitcoin is the only asset that is truly scarce. And it is the only asset with 0% terminal inflation rate.
And putting this in terms of stock to flow, Bitcoin's stock to flow is currently 50 compared to gold's 55. It will shoot up to 100 in the next 3 years because of the halving event in 2024. With every halving, Bitcoin's stock to flow is going to approximately double. And that will make it harder and harder as a form of money. Bitcoin is the only truly scarce asset that we know of.
Yeah.
So the other thing that's truly scarce is your time. Whatever work you do, you want to store it in Bitcoin because you want to trade true scarcity for true scarcity. If you want to trade your time for something like gold or like some US dollar, those are not truly scarce. So again,
I think we will soon cover, like you will soon start to understand money is essentially time. You're essentially trading the fruits of your labor into a tradable commodity, which you can spend later. Like I'm doing 1 hour worth of work, which I want to save it for later, where I want to enjoy the fruits of my labor later. That's what money is essentially. And you start to understand time is money. And when you start to see government printing money, which is free time is not free. You can't create time out of thin air. So then it starts to click. Then you start to see how the fiat dollar is gonna go worthless because there's no respect to time. So yeah, we will cover that again. So I think we can close by saying money is something that needs to be saleable across time and space. Gold champion money that was saleable across time, and fiat like a paperback currency sort of because of its divisibility, it was saleable across space. I think Bitcoin with all its money properties, it's saleable across both time and space.
So I think this is a good time to end this episode, because again, Bitcoin is better than gold, at being gold itself. And again, we want to cover more about how Bitcoin works, what's 21 million, you know, how the idea of mining works, etc.
Yeah, we have more topics lined up as we dive deeper into the rabbit hole. So hope you join us again. Hey, if you've made it this far, thanks for listening in. If you enjoyed the conversation, be sure to subscribe to the show. You can also send us your feedback to hello@bitcoininfinitypodcast.com or visit our website, bitcoininfinitypodcast.com. We're also on Twitter at Bitcoin8Podcast. That is BITCOIN number 8 podcast. As always, this show is meant for educational purposes only and is not financial advice.